All right. Well, thank you so much for the intro. I speak. I begin this topic with actually a decent amount of trepidation, because even though I am not, I think I'm not formally employed, at least from a tax sense, by Young Israel Plainview, so I don't have the same responsibilities to not speak about politics. I very strongly feel that from like the rabbinate, there should be little engagement from politics. I don't think that's the purview the rabbinate has. So I'm trying to avoid as much as possible any direct political conversation, even though on private one-on-one level, I have a lot of views and I'm happy to share them. So I want to discuss then something that I have thought a lot about as the Trump presidency is coming to an official end in a few days, in about 10 days or so, is that there's been a lot of discussion about the role of civil disobedience on both sides of the aisle. The role of protests, the role of when violence is maybe permitted, when is it not permitted, when is it not sanctioned, and really the role of how the average citizen reacts to government policies or government officials that they find particularly troublesome for whatever reason. And I so I what I want to do instead of focusing on this issue as a whole, because I think it's a really difficult issue that will take a lot of work. What I want to do is really explore this issue by looking through the lens of one particular Jewish thinker, Rabbi Yehuda Henkin Zatzal, a modern Orthodox giant, really, who really lives in the Dati Lumi community in Israel. Someone who grew up in America. He went to Flatbush in Brooklyn, so he grew up in a modern Orthodox home. He ended up learning most of his Torah, ended up learning with his grandfather, Rav Yosef Henkin, who is one of those forgotten American Gedolim, who lived on Lower East Side, right around the same, a little bit earlier than Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Moshe Feinstein became a lot more famous, but Rav Yosef Henkin really was one of the Gedolim in the generation that preceded him. And so Rav Yehuda Henkin, his grandson, learned with his grandfather and then made Aliyah in the 70s, and really became a very strong force for Dati Lumi Judaism, really embodying modern orthodoxy and the values of modern orthodoxy. And if you look through like a sample of his tshuvas, you can find a lot of the tshuvas relating to U.S. halacha, to women's role in davening, and all sorts of modern issues from perspective that modern orthodox people relate to that he really discusses. So I thought he'd be an interesting person, both because he recently passed away, so it's worthwhile learning some of his Torah, but also because he really engages with the topic, and you might not agree with everything he says. I'm definitely open to disagreement, but I think he engages with it with a modern world view, in that he accepts from his perspective a lot of the issues. He accepts the role of the government, the fact that we support the government overall, while also being willing to really acknowledge that we might disagree with specific policies, and therefore how to respond to those specific policies. So for this shiur, what I want to do is I want to discuss really two main issues, which appear in three different tshuvas, three different articles of sorts that Rav Henkin has written throughout his life, and really get a sense through his articles of both the way he thinks and also the way he interacts, so to speak, with this issue of civil disobedience in halacha. All right, so I'm going to share my screen. If you have any questions, as always, feel free to stop, interrupt me, or to put a comment. In the chat box. So the first tshuva that I'm going to discuss is this rather long article. I cut out a lot of it. It's in Hebrew. I discovered just about 25 minutes before the shiur that he actually has an English version written in one of the books he published called, I think it's called Tzniut or something. Tzniut, I forgot the exact title. There is an English article he published. I don't have access to it. Somebody sent me pictures of it. It's pretty similar to this article in Hebrew. I don't have access to it on the screen, but if you're willing, I'm happy to send you a link if you want to read the full article in English. It might be. Okay, great. So he has it. I think it's on page 123. You can read through it. It's pretty similar to this article in Hebrew. But here's how he begins. The topic that he discusses is a topic that's, at least from America, it's a little bit divorced. It's been an issue that almost took place almost 15 years ago, which is the Hitnakut from Gush Katif. Meaning the what's the English translation in the code with the expulsion, the what's the common word people use? Disengagement, yeah. Disengagement. Right? When when Ariel Sharon and the Israeli government in 2005, I believe it was, decided to trade land for peace to give over Gush Katif, a large part of the Gaza Strip, formerly to Palestinian Authority towards the people of Gaza in exchange for peace. And it was a lot of demonstrations about that specifically because there were a large number of Jews who lived in Gush Katif specifically, and there were a lot of protests about it. And there was really a lot of discussion at the time what the role of people who believed in the state, not Haredim who disagree with the state and don't believe it's not Jewish and don't believe that it has no religious authority, but people who really believe in the state, believe in Medinat Yisrael, believe in Tzahal as a whole, what their reaction should therefore be in terms of a policy that they strongly disagreed with, that they felt was anti-Torah, and maybe it was anti-productive, maybe it would lead to the decimation of Israel as a whole because it would lead to further radicalizing terrorists. What should they do if you had that reaction, right, in this situation? So he writes a tshuva on the topic, and this is how he starts. Okay, he starts as follows. I think this is very informative to how he looks at halacha in general. Akadim l'diyun ha'aram mitodit al odot tfisa hatalich hilchatish nitcheh al devarai. So he speaks in very, this is very modern Hebrew. So if you're not used to reading in modern Hebrew, this is it's not really, this is not halachic Hebrew, it's very modern. So he says, I'll begin with the following methodological point about the process of halacha. Shlosha elementim bepsika. There are three typical aspects to psak halacha. Halacha, mitziyut, v'hora'ah. There's halacha, there's the reality, the situation, and there's hora, meaning the psak, like what the rav tells you to do. Halacha hi ha-torah ha-tehora. Halacha is pure Torah, the law itself. Ha-nidlik mitoch ha-svarim, which can be emerged from the law books, from Shulchan Aruch, from the Gemara. Ha-mitziyut hi matzav b'shetach. Mitziyut refers to the actual situation, what you can see on the ground, so to speak. Right, she told you that halacha has to relate to, right, has to relate, you have to relate to the reality on the ground. And to relate to between these two aspects, between the pure law, what's written in Shulchan Aruch, and to relate to the reality on the ground, a specific shaila, a specific question that's being asked, that's what hora is, that's what psak is, relating between these two different aspects. So there are a bunch of rules. He explains, like, b'dievet, shatat chak, a bunch of rules that halacha, that psak halacha relates to in order to relate between the psak, between reality and the law. He says as follows. However, b'derech klal, mitoreret machloket b'tchum halacha. Generally, there's a generally, most of the discussion, when the posek writes his tshuva, most of the discussion is going to surround what is the actual law. So if you read a tshuva, you're going to see like a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. He's going to say, this was the question that was asked of me. This is the reality. The reality is fairly simple. But the halacha, the law itself, is very difficult. So then he goes on for several pages, going to explain, there is this shita, says this opinion, a different shita says something else. And what he really has to deal with is the halacha, what the law in its pure form says about the din. But and there's very little discussion about the actual reality. However, when it comes to ideological discussions, the reverse is true. The dido shel nisha sover gula bepetach rak harei gula nefachet lechelak min hamitziut. If you believe, for instance, in this case about Israel policies and disengagement from land, from certain land that you give over to Palestinians. If you believe that the geula is bepetach, that there actually is redemption is here, so then redemption becomes part of not just your worldview, but becomes practically part of what the mitzvot is, how you view reality. Reality is we live in the time of redemption. And therefore the mitzvot, the actual reality is going to have a large change, and the hora, therefore the psak, is going to make a big difference. Tafkid haposek hu leamit kechol sheafshar ha-pishikulim she'enan besis ivudati mitoch ha-akara she'gam ha-arechet ha-vodot ha-nosot li'itim opit subjektivi. So the role of the posek then is to try removing as much as possible any subjective judgment, because there is going to be a lot of subjective judgment in these topics. And his point here is that and this really comes down to a lot of Rav Henkin's thought, is that he was a posek who really thought and cared a lot about halacha, and he spent a long time talking about halacha. But at the end of the day, and you look through a lot of his psak halacha, he'll give a whole long essay, several pages worth of halacha, only to then say at some point, but all of this has to be contended with the actual reality on the ground, and since the reality on the ground does not conform to exactly what I'm saying, therefore psak halacha will not go the following way. And if you look at it, there's a bunch of tshuvas like that, even on very modern issues. To give you one example that's like a more controversial issue that I've read his writings on, he has a writing about partnership minyanim that he has a whole discussion, and he has a whole perspective where he suggests maybe there is really room to be to permit partnership minyanim for A and B reasons. He has a whole discussion about it, but then he concludes at the end that actually, because the reality on the ground does not conform to anything what I'm saying, because I'm concerned about all these other ancillary issues, he thinks that his whole halachic analysis is not actually relevant in the given situation. And this is something that he really deals with a lot. What is the reality on the ground? Okay, so now let's get straight into the tshuva itself. How does he relate to this topic? So the first thing he says, and I bring this up, it's kind of a side point, but it's really the first thing he says, and I think it's interesting, especially I believe for like people who live in the Galut, live in, you know, in the diaspora. He mentions the following. There's a very long-standing view to think of Israel, the success of Israel, right? The fact that it's startup nation, that that we have the success in land of Israel as a kind of a proof that we live in the time of redemption. And Rav Hinken makes the very subtle point that, in fact, from Tanakh itself, you may suggest the exact opposite. There's no real proof that we live in time of redemption just because we've had success militarily, because we had success creating a nation. And he brings the proof from the story of Yerovam HaShini, from the second Yerovam. Because the story is told in Malachim Bet that the second Yerovam, right, was a very wicked king. And nonetheless, because of the way that the geopolitical climate had worked back then, that just at his time, the Assyrian army had gone down, and the Babylonians, or sorry, the Assyrians had not yet come back up, but the Armenians, Aram had descended. Just at that particular moment in history, Yerovam and the kingdom of Israel was really able to succeed, become a very successful and prosperous nation, and that was true despite the fact that Yerovam was a very wicked king. And so his point is that the very fact that we have success does not prove our righteousness. So we don't actually know for a fact we live in the Geula, live in the time of redemption. And I think this is a really important perspective to consider when talking about, in general, our relationship to land of Israel and to whether or not we live in a Zman of Geula or not. It's a longer discussion, but I thought this was an interesting point he makes. Either way, as he moves on in his tshuva, he points out the following afterwards. He says, "What about, so how do we relate to the government as a whole, right? Do we view the government, which is a secular government, right? In Israel, it's a secular government, and especially in America, where it's really not a Jewish government at all in any capacity. How do we relate to the power, to the samchut, meaning the jurisdiction, to the normative force of the law you have to listen to, you have to obey by the rules of a secular government?" And so he says, Chad v'chalak, it's very black on white. He believes that samchut memshalat kilonit, a secular government, has full autonomy. It must be listened to. He's pretty clear about it. Samchut memshalat kilonit memshalat yesh reshut lanhig miniyut shela. A secular government has the right to come up with its own policies. V'lachein lichor yesh la samchut lachria gam shelot shel sakana lumit, and therefore it also has the ability to make decisions that are life-threatening to the nation itself. He quotes Rav Kook, who makes this point. He quotes also Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, who makes a similar point. If you want to read Waldenberg, he says as follows: "Gam b'yameinu ha'nasi v'hamemshala, in our day and age, the president and the government, v'haknesset, and the Congress, the Knesset, shenivcharu b'da'at rov Yisrael ha'yoshevim al admatam, b'makom melachim omdim b'chol hanogea l'masav ha'klali shel ha'umah ha'drushim l'sha'atam l'mamad ha'olam." That the Knesset, the government, stands for all of Israel, and they have the right to make decisions about the welfare of the people of Israel in the state. And then he makes this really interesting point, which I think is which I think is often overlooked, which is how do we then deal with sorry. So and he makes this really interesting point, which is follows. כלומר, במה שאינו גיל לדעת, יש להחליטן תוקף. זוהי מסקנת מבקשת. This is a very obvious conclusion that all secular governments, even governments which are created by Rishayim, right, really people who are evil people, and this is often the Haredi response or to secular government in Israel. It's not made by Jews. It's not made by religious Jews. It's not made with the Torah in mind. The Torah is not the guiding legal principle holding the government. So why should the government of Israel have any legal standing? Why should halacha not be the guiding rule of the land? And why should we listen to what Bibi Netanyahu says, right? Why should we listen to Tzipi Livni or whoever the person in the government is right now, Yair Lapid? Like, why should we care about what they have to say? And so he makes this really important argument, which is v'chi na'ale al hadat shitzibor rishayim eno yichol lehamlich alav melach. Would we come up with the impossible suggestion that a non-Jewish, an evil society cannot make themselves king? Right? His point is that even the religious nature of a king does not determine whether or not the king or the government has a claim to their hegemony. Right? Their claim to authority is not dependent upon their righteousness. Right, even evil societies have a full right to having kings. And therefore, the religious nature of, the religious observance of the Knesset, of the government of Israel, is irrelevant when dealing with how, with the government of, with dealing with whether or not there is autonomy. You have to listen to, the government of Israel. And he makes the following, he adds the following point as well. When the Rambam list what is righteous for a king. So there are all these rules about what a king has to do, and the Rambam says, I can source here, Navi Shemin Melach Mishar Shiftei Yisrael, part of anointing a king is that there has to be an anointing process through a Navi, through a prophet, and he has to do all the mitzvot, Harizeh Melach B'chol Mitzvot HaMalchun Agibo, he has to follow all the mitzvot, he has to follow the Torah and follow whatever the ways of David HaMelach, and his point is, so the suggestion that the Haredim often bring is, doesn't that prove that anyone who does not follow Torah to Moshe, does not follow the Torah in its proper, in all its ordinances, doesn't that prove that they are not the righteous king, that they don't have a righteous, they don't have a rightful claim to the government? And he suggests that no, when the Rambam refers to all those rules, that's only with regard to what's called a melech, who has all the rules of the Torah. Right, so the king, the Torah lists all these rules that a righteous king has. He can't have too many wives. He can't have too much money. He can't have, he has to have a Torah attached to him all the time. He has to have God on his lips. Right, all these rules about what a righteous king has to do. But it's very clear that even if you're not a righteous king, you still have the status of a king and all that comes with it. And therefore, the status of the government is not determined by the wickedness of the government, the members of the government, the people who are in charge of the government, or people who voted them in. Once they are voted in, once they are voted in by the people, that itself gives them the power to govern, and they're not limited in any capacity. Okay, then he has a long, any question? No, okay. Then he has a long discussion about whether or not there's something wrong. I skipped this whole part. Whether there's something wrong with having left, with the disengagement, is there something wrong with the Torah leaving disengagement? He had a whole discussion about it. He ends up pretty, he does think there are some problems with it, but it's really beyond our topic. I don't want to focus too much on the particular issue, because I want to really focus on civil disengagement in general. And he has the following, I think, really interesting points about civil disengagement, which I think are worth discussing. He has the following. Let's return to our original discussion, because the original essay, he talks about sinat chinam, hatred between, unbased hatred. האם לאור הדיון במקורות, ראוי לשאול לפי כל מאבק על הסוגיה המדינית, כגון זה שהיה במהלך הנקטות מגוש קטיף ועוד יותר בהרס הבתים בעמונה, האם נכון לוותר כדי למנוע סנן חילם ופילוג בעם? Yes, let's say you do disapprove of the government's actions, right? And you do want to protest. Is it worth, when it comes to, should we be concerned about creating discord in the people, right? Discord among different among the nations, right? Is that a concern which makes any protest unjustified or right? Should you be concerned that by protesting you are driving a wedge in society, that you're splitting, say, in our society, Republicans and Democrats, and you're only furthering the discord, only furthering the gap? Should that be a concern you have anytime you want to protest against a policy like the disengagement from Gush Katif or the destruction of houses in Amona, a town in Samaria? Sharei afilu imam hamshala poelat b'istur, because even if the government is doing something wrong, ki yadua chamira sakanta m'istura. There's a general rule that sakanta, danger, right, dangerous situations are worse than isura, than doing something wrong. V'lachein ulai yesh la'adif miniat sakanat pilug al kol shikul acher af hilchati. And therefore, maybe even if you conclude that in this particular discussion, point about protesting disengagement from land in Israel, maybe nonetheless you should avoid protesting because it's going to create discord throughout the people, right? Is that going to be enough of a halachic factor that you should prevent any protests? So he says as follows: He thinks, at least in this case, it's not clear how far he holds this to be true, but definitely in this case, the particular case he's talking about, disengagement, he thinks this is not a valid concern. Because ha-minagdim le-pinui yishuvim tuanim shenishkefet sakana kiyumit le-medina mi'amdiniyut shel viturim le-palestinim le-lo t'murah v'shesakana zu eina nofelet b'chumartam mesakenet pilug ba'am v'chein yish le-sakel medinyut zu. He thinks that in this particular case, if you really believe if you really believe that there is something inherently wrong with disengagement, so then you're going to also believe that there's going to be serious consequences to having disengagement. It's going to create problems of security. It's going to have create problems in society as a whole. And therefore, in this particular case of disengagement, talking about peace is not a worthwhile discussion, right? Bringing it, I guess, closer to issues in America, you can make a claim that to those people who respond that, protesting any particular issue is going to create a wedge between Republicans and between liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, the response could be there already is that wedge, and if I don't protest now, then the wedge is only going to be further created. And I need to take a stand here because otherwise the consequences are only going to make things worse. And that's definitely his argument here. Zot ve'od al pi hashkafatam hamshalah hi melabe et ha'esh hakera ba'am. He adds additionally, who is making this discord in the nation? It's the government itself. It's the propaganda, effectively, that the government itself is creating. That the government itself is propping up this narrative of these two opposite sides, right? Think of politicians, both sides of the aisle, probably true, who create very strong impressions that there is this huge discord between. There's this huge split in the country. And the argument he makes is that by not protesting, you're only allowing that narrative that they're creating, that there is this gap, to only further propagate. And that to really stop the propagation of discord, you actually need to take a stand to prove that you don't agree with the government's policies, and that the government's creation of these, two opposite sides, this narrative it's creating is actually false. On the other end, then that's effectively his interesting argument about why this case is that you shouldn't be worried about the consequence that that having protests is going to create a situation of lack of peace. And he adds also, in a particular case in Israel, he adds that there's no expertise because both sides have valid experts on their particular position. Right, both the more conservative, more hawkish Israelis, and the more past, more peace oriented liberal Israelis, they both have plenty of expertise in the military. They both have what to rely on, and there's no one expert in either context. He then continues to say, in general, so. This is something I want to focus on this for a second. He makes the following point, which I think is it's a really interesting and important thing to think about. This it comes bring us back to the discussion of the government as a whole. Do we have to, when we talk about listening to the government, right? He had a whole proof that the secular government has a lot of authority. So now he returns back to this point, and this question is, when you have do you have to listen to the secular government? Is there a normative rule that you actually have to listen to what the government says? And he makes this actually really interesting argument. And it's not really fully fleshed out here, it's fleshed out in other places. But what he effectively argues is that the government has the right to penalize you, and you have to listen to what's penalizing you, but there's not necessarily any rule that you have to listen to what the government says, right? The actual rule of the government is not necessarily normative, but the penalty that they impose is normative. Let me give you an example, which to make it a little clearer. There's a whole discussion about dien mahuta dina, the discussion that a lot of posts can talk about as the normative basis for how we know we have to listen to our government, our secular government, the American government. So the rule is dien mahuta dina, the rule of the government is law. And there's a lot of discussion in Shulchan Aruch and Poskim as to what the extent, what is the scope of the government's right to make laws. And at least according to some Rishonim, the government's scope is limited to only things which are monetary by nature, not things which are, let's say, quote, the Shach bin Adam l'chaveiro, things which are between one man and his friend. The government cannot legislate or has no binding normative force, only things which are monetary by nature. And not everyone agrees. The Ramah quotes an opinion that disagrees with that, thinks that no, the government has the right to legislate on any issue. And Rosh Shimon Shkup has this really, I think, interesting and informative way of looking at this issue. He suggests that the government, when we talk about the government's ability to legislate, it's true that it's limited to monetary issues. Meaning that the government can say that, can establish who owns what money, who owns certain properties, and who owes property to each other, who is stealing property from another person. But the government does not have the right to say that, right, that you have to follow certain rules that don't have anything to do with money. But they can penalize you for not following their laws. So, for instance, take an example, right? The government does not have the right, Rav Shimon Shkup argues, not that didn't give this example, but in general, he argues the government does not have a right, for instance, to legislate that you have to take out your recycling. You have to recycle. You have to separate out your plastics from your regular garbage, and you have to recycle. The government, his argument, could argument could be that it does not have the right to do so, but the government does have the right to say that if you don't do it, then we're going to fine you. You're gonna have to pay a penalty. So in Rav Shimon Shkup's argument is that it's true that the average Jew does not have to listen to the government. There's nothing compelling you to listen to the government, but it's on your head if the government catches you and requires you to pay a fine. And maybe for that reason, there's going to be other problems, concerns with Ava, and maybe she'll listen to the government, even if they did not. So they're going to catch you for various reasons. But the point he's making is that the government, listening to the government itself is not necessarily a prescriptive rule. You don't necessarily have to listen to the government because prescriptively it's normative like halacha is, but it is descriptive in the sense that at the end of the day, if you don't listen to the government, it's going to be on your head and you're going to be penalized for it. And that's what the government can do. And that's what effectively allows him to suggest that you can protest, right? That move, this intellectual move of suggesting that that there's no actual normative or ethical requirement to listen to everything the government says, but only there's an ethical requirement that if you don't, then you're going to be penalized for it. That's what allows him to suggest that you're capable to protest. Because otherwise, he could have suggested that there's no room for civil disobedience if there is a real moral requirement, right? An ethical imperative that requires you to listen to everything the government says. And so, because in his argument, in fact, there is no ethical imperative to listen to what the government says, you can disobey, you can protest. Just be aware that it'll be on your head, if the government catches you and decides to fine you for it. And so that's the middle ground that he effectively plays with, where you are able to challenge the government, but you're going to have to be, but you're going to have to at the same time acknowledge that the government might penalize you for it, and that's what you're going to have to, that's what you're going to have to contend with. And he makes this very clear in the very last paragraph of his rather long tshuva, where he says as follows: "It's unclear then; it's hard to exactly establish what the limitations, what are the rules binding, when you should protest and or how you should protest and when you can't. And in some capacity, he argues, it's going to be dependent on what is considered to be normal in society." Lidugma, for example, Chasimat Smatim Haita Emsa'im Kubal Shanim. For many years, a typical, an established way of protesting the government was by creating roadblocks, by setting up roadblocks that was considered to be a legitimate form of protest, at least in Israel, I guess. V'lachein, this is not considered to be a full rebellion. Even though obviously creating roadblocks creates a lot of challenges to people. Nonetheless, it's very clear that the government has the right to penalize you for creating roadblocks. Despite the fact that in the past it was considered to be a normal thing to do. So you clearly are playing in this middle ground of where he believes that civil disobedience is permitted because there is no ethical imperative to listen to what the government says, but it's on your head. You're taking a risk that the government may punish you for doing so. And therefore, he suggests that this is going to be very much dependent. What you should do in practice is going to be very dependent, A, on like what's the norm, right? So if the norm is to congregate in, in certain squares, then that's going to be normal to do, even if it blocks traffic. And two, he adds something else. It's going to depend on what exactly you're protesting and how serious you think this particular cause of yours is. I think that's the next paragraph. Mikol makom, mi shesover sheyesh b'mdiniyut hinaktut hinachsut mishum sakanat yumit. If you believe this particular policy the government has, it is a real, it's almost an existential problem to the nation's health, to the safety of the country, then you will not leave just, you will not be righteous in the eyes of God if you do not protest appropriately against the government's policies. And a person therefore has to protest, has to act based on his conscience. And a person should be careful not to follow any avera. So it sounds like he's implying don't damage property, don't hurt people. Although he doesn't really specify what that means. And he says, "Ein li pale im ein hagderot berur lakach." You should not be surprised if there are no explicit guidelines guiding what you should do. Share bayot misubachot einan nitalot pritok kalim. Because complicated issues, issues which require real thought and are dependent, each particular situation is its own situation. There are no simple situations. Kamo, parallel, she'en hagdarot ke'ele l'chiyuv ha'makbil she'et la'asot Hashem. Just as in the parallel concept when it comes to religious issues of et la'asot Hashem, efeiro toratecha, that when it comes to exceptions in a religious sphere, when it comes to things that the rabbis felt that people were not following halacha for whatever reason, they're able to make exceptions. So there too, there are no clear guidelines. So his argument is that here too, when it comes to civil disobedience, there are no clear guidelines. And it's up to each person to decide based on their own conscience as to what they're willing to do and what risk they feel they should have to take and they can take in a situation. And he adds at the end, like I mentioned again, you have to be aware this whole time you're going to potentially have to pay a personal price for doing this. All right, so that's, so to speak, his response to this issue of civil disobedience in general. And I think it's definitely a more, I call it a more modern perspective in the sense that, as I mentioned earlier, he does believe in the government's right to legislate. He's not one of those people who believes that the government has no right, that the Chiloni government shouldn't be cared for. He cares for the government. But he believes that civil disobedience is something which is written in to the way that we listen to the government. The way that we approach government, the way we have to listen to it, the ethical imperative that mandates that we listen to what the government laws have within them the perspective that civil disobedience is something we can do. We may be penalized for it, but disobeying the government itself is not wrong. That's effectively his major perspective that appears here. And he mentions again, and I only bring this up again a second time because I've heard the argument has come up in modern times. I mean, that's why people have taken more drastic measures. I'm not going to speak about the specifics of our particular 2020 American politics, but there has been discussion about this time is a specific time. It's an exceptional time. It's a time where the ordinary rules of protest and what is permitted, not permitted, go out the window. And in fact, in a later tshuva, he wrote later that very same year, he responds to a tshuva on the same issue, and he responds that actually, b'yamim tikunam, if on a usual time, I would agree with you about the rules, responding to Rabbi Yehuda Zoldan, a particular author's response to when is protest. And how is permitted and how should protests be conducted? And he says, usually I'd agree with you, but it happens to be our particular situation based on the government's work and way, based on the way he believes the peace situation in Israel was working at the time. He believes this is an exceptional time, and therefore the general rules don't apply. And therefore, he makes a different claim about what protesting is. And to really appreciate that, I think it'll be worthwhile turning for a few minutes to this other tshuva that I want to point out, where he also addresses protesting in a very different context. Any questions thus far as we switch gears? No. Okay. So there is another tshuva. He does spend, I skipped some of this, he does spend some time explaining where the government has the right, so to speak, to create laws and create penalties for laws. He doesn't fully expound his whole theory of where civil disobedience works and kind of this middle ground. Part of that is, a lot of it is what I'm picking up between the lines of what his argument generally is, which is, I think, is a really fascinating argument. I don't think it definitely it's a type of argument that exists within modern political thinkers, but it's not. He doesn't. He is a little bit misvara. It's not very clear where exactly he gets some of these details, and I'm not sure he has too much direct proof for a lot for like that the essential point that we're really hanging on to about the line between where you have to listen to government and the fact that you get penalized if you don't. Good question. All right, anything else? Any other questions? All right, so I think that there is another tshuva, which relates in a very different way to this general concept of protesting, and I think it's informative in a different sense. And this tshuva is a tshuva written in the 1980s, written in 1988, relating to Hafkanot Leman Yehudi Rusia, protests on behalf of the Jews living in the USSR who were being persecuted, who were unable to practice their Judaism. And there was a lot of movements at the time protesting the situation of the Jews in Russia and in USSR. He's relating to, I guess, some people had protested or argued to him that it should be unjust. They shouldn't be able to protest. It was something anti-Torah to protest. And he really spends the whole tshuva sourcing the fact that protesting is something very Jewish. So the question that somebody asked him about protests in general for the Jews living in the USSR, and specifically protests that specific protests that happened in Washington, that this particular person asked, the Shaila asked, and she said the following source should really prove this. And if you know like Jewish history, it's very common to have protested against these type of decrees. The following story is really the source, where he shows that protesting is something which has happened for Jews for generations, for centuries. The Masechet Tanit, which is a book full of days where we do not fast, says that on the 28th of, I think it's Adar, Ata bishurata tavata liyuda delo yudim araita. It's a good day for Jews, and we do not avoid learning Torah. Shegadra malchut gzeirash lo yasku b'Torah, because that in the Romans at the time had made a decree that the Jews should not learn Torah, shlo yamulu et b'nei yishachelu shabbatot, that they should they can't circumcise their children and they can't keep Shabbos. Ma'asa Yehuda ben Shemua v'chevirav. So Yehuda ben Shemua and his friends halchuv natlu etzami matronita achat shekol gedolei romi mitzuyin etzla. They went to this very well-known, famous matron, Roman matron, who was very popular among the Romans. Amra lahem. So they asked her advice, and she responded to them, "What you should do? Bo v'yifgunu b'layla. So go and protest at night." Halchu v'yifgunu b'layla. They went down and protested at night. Amru. They cried out loud. They made made signs that said, "Ishamayim lo achich lo achichem anachnu v'lo bnei av echad anachnu." Are we not one? Are we not brothers? Are we not brethren? Are we not the father of one? Are we not all humans that were the sons of one parent? V'lo bnei am achat anachnu. Manishtinu mikol uma. What are we different from other countries, other nations in the world? Shatem gozim aleinu gzero kashot, that you are decreeing specifically on us decrees and not on other nations. V'hi brayta sachas. I mean, so that's the brayta in that story. And so Rav Hinkin proves from this story certain key principles about the right to protest. He says, first, you can see from this story that there's use, that the reason that night is useful, he points out, is because night is a good time for when it's very public, when people, when the message is well heard. He also makes this interesting point, which I think is points to his more modern thinking, is that the advantage of the night in the story was also that it was a time when the children could be put to bed, and that the woman could also come and join the protests, because these issues affected women too, and they too could come and join the protest. Alright, so then he says the following. Okay, so we see that the reason for, how do we, so now he said, so now let's compare the protest of Rehuda ben Shemua and our protest, meaning the protest of for Russian Jewry. He said, in the time of the Gemara, they protested specifically things which come to the essence of what Jewish practice is. Now learning Torah, circumcision, Shabbos, right? Things which are essential to being a practicing Jew. And he says, today it's also true that you shouldn't only protest for things that a nefesh Yisrael tluya b'hem, only something that a Jewish, soul is dependent upon. He doesn't expand fully. It's something that I really wish he had more tshuvas on, like how this relates to other issues, like political issues of our time, what he believes are things that, especially if they don't relate only to Jews, relate to the world as a whole. But in our particular issue, he's relating to Jews and Jewish issues. And his argument is that even though in Russia, their lives of the Jews was not in danger, nonetheless, they were unable to circumcise their kids. They were unable to keep Shabbos. The rules were preventing any education, any Jewish education. And he thinks that's comparable to this Gemara, and therefore is permissible, or and therefore really it's advisable to protest. He points out, and I think this is something he deals with a lot, and it comes back to the same thing about the modern issue. He brings up the fact that some people have protested. So some people have quoted Rav Moshe Feinstein that you shouldn't protest. And also other people have quoted the Bishato Agrid Soloveitchik, or Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, who also said you shouldn't protest. And he argues, Hinei leni otati, kevin shinyan hafganot nilman me'agmara, v'rak tzarich livdok lifnei kol hafganah im titzmach imena to'elet olo kmo shekatavti. He says, in effect, that we can't rely on previous rabbinic edicts about protests, because every protest, every generation, every year has a different, have their own issues. And you can't rely on what the Rub said 30 years ago, or Moshe said 60 years ago, or even what Irv Hankin said 10 years ago, because every issue is going to be its own issue. And this is really a theme, which I think bring us back to almost the first point I brought up, which is that every and a lot of Irv Hankin's thought relates to the practicalities of our current time. And he believed very strongly that Psak Halacha has to relate to our specific time. And not only that, but he makes this point, and this is in the previous Shiva we quoted that I didn't highlight as much, but he makes the point that it's not even clear that in our particular case, the person to go to are poskim, right? If you ask someone from more Haredi-minded, they might say that yes, you can protest, maybe like an issue like the Russian Jewry situation, something you should protest. But they'll say, you know who you have to ask, you know who you have to how you engage with this issue, you should go and ask the Gedolim, because the Gedolim know. The Gedolim are the people you should respond to. Those are the people who can tell you when it's right to protest, when it's not right to protest. And Rav Hinkin, throughout his thought, consistently argues that against that position. He argues that it's important to know the facts. It's important to know the consequences of what you're doing, to know the reality, and therefore it's worth asking experts. But the Gedolim are not necessarily the source of the expertise. And at the end of the day, he believes very strongly in the autonomy of each individual. That each of us on our own have a responsibility to figure out when is it right for us to protest, to respond to government policies, to unfair situations around the world, human rights problems throughout the world, in America and then abroad. And that's something that's upon each of us to decide on our own. And he makes a very strong point that really this self-autonomy is what governs a lot of the policies of when it comes to protest. And I think that's why I find some of his tshuvas to be so compelling. Because I don't necessarily agree with his assessment of old situations. I mean, I don't really know enough about the disengagement to make an accurate assessment of my feelings on that issue. I can't speak to Russian Jewry specifically either, although I'm not sure why you would disagree with it. But I do feel very strongly that the way he relates to protests in general, the fact that there is a strong highlight, a strong element in his position, which focuses on the self-autonomy to make your own decisions as to when you think an issue is serious enough that deserves protesting, and with the consequences that protesting might accompany. And he believes strongly that you should protest if you really believe in it. It's really going to depend a lot on your conscience. And he might not allow every type of response, right? It's not clear. He mentioned in the earlier tshuva, you couldn't go against halacha, which sounds like you can't even damage property. But he does seem to allow for other types of civil disobedience. As I said earlier, I wish he had gone into more detail what exactly he meant by where that line was of things that were allowed, which aren't allowed. But he does make this very strong point. And he's not willing to, he's not shying away from being really forceful in the role that we as modern Jews living in our world have, to engage forcefully with our surroundings, with our government, and to really engage, whether for pro or for con. And I think it's a really interesting tshuva, a really interesting perspective, that he has on his issues. So I'll end with that here. I'm happy to take questions, if anybody has any questions on his thought in general or on the specific issue. Again, I will try refraining from any specific politics relating to America in the 21st century. It's a little more dicey. But thank you again for everyone for listening, and I hope you were all able to appreciate a little bit of what I think is. What is really a great thinker we had that passed away just recently, and his effect on the modern Orthodox community and the Tehillim community in Israel specifically, really had a very strong effect. Okay, great.